Good morning, you old marbleites.
Good
morning, you live streamers out there. How are you doing out there, you live streamers? Get yourself another cup of coffee. Today we're going to talk about the Via Dolorosa, the way of sorrows, the Latin version of the Hebrew, the way of pain. Today is Palm Sunday. It is in the Catholic Church. It's called the Sunday of the Passion. And in a lot of churches, what they'll do today is read the Passion narrative, the story of Jesus suffering and death. And they do that on the Sunday before Palm Sunday a lot in churches because they know that some people won't go to church on Good Friday and they won't hear that story. And the story of the resurrection doesn't really make sense for us unless we have also heard the bad news, the story of the crucifixion. So today we're going to talk about what people have done with the story of Jesus' journey toward the cross throughout the ages. We know basically what happened, that he's arrested in the Garden of Gethsemane, right? Then he's taken in. He is humiliated by the guards and stripped of his garments. They put a robe on him. They put a crown of thorns in his face. He goes before Pilate, the governor, because they want to condemn him. And the leaders go with them to ask Pilate to condemn him. And Pilate, as you remember, says, well, I don't know that he's done anything wrong. And so they have a bit of an argument about that. And in the end, he famously washes his hands, from which we wash our hands of this. And said, go ahead and do with him what you will. How about if we just beat him? No. So the crowd then shouts, crucify him. And in the Gospel of John, Barabbas is offered as a, maybe we could just have you choose between one or the other of them. We talked, I think, 2 weeks ago about Barabbas and how real that was. We introduced some question about that. And, you either bought it or you didn't. But that there may not have been a custom to release somebody during the Passover, that there is no attestation of that beyond Christian sources. So anyway, it goes on, and he's then shuttled back and forth between some various authorities. And because nobody in authority wants anything to do with him, really, they're scared of the reaction of the crowd. They're certainly scared of their Roman overlords. So he's kind of shuttled back and forth. But in the end, he is led out to be crucified. They make him carry his own cross. Did he carry a big cross like the one we see, a cross like that? Or did he just carry the horizontal bar of it already strapped to it? I don't know. We read in three of the Gospels that at one point he falls under its weight, and Simon of Cyrene is asked to carry his cross. Asked. He is told he's going to carry that cross, and he does. And he meets the women of Jerusalem, and they have an exchange. And then he gets to the cross, and he is put up on it. They hammer nails into his hands and feet, and it takes him 3 hours to die. And he does die. You remember maybe growing up that the ministers in town would have a kind of a preach-a-thon about the seven last words of the cross. Well, the seven last words come from all four Gospels, and all seven last words are not in any of the four Gospels. So you have to kind of grab a word from here and there, like I thirst and woman, behold your son. They don't all appear in the same gospel, but they all appear in all four of them. And that's, at least in America, a very traditional thing to do on Good Friday. from 12 to 3 is to have this preach-a-thon. And how many remember that from growing up? All the ministers. And all the ministers would come from the different churches. And then their people from those churches would come and kind of root for their guy. And, I've done many, many of those, and I like them. I know that the seven last words, in a way, they're not, real, because they don't hang together historically in all four Gospels, but they're useful, and I've heard a lot of good sermons about those seven last words, real or not. For a long time, there has been a desire on the part of Christians to participate personally in this time, to in some way revisit and reenact what happened to Jesus. Now, that's interesting, because they don't necessarily reenact other things in his life. They don't reenact miracles that I know of. I mean, if you go to a Jesus movie, certainly you'll see that. But that Christians have gotten together and reenacted, the raising of Lazarus or the healing of the blind man, I don't know that that has happened much. But this, those last hours, those last days, Christians have for a long, long time wanted to reenact it and have. And so I want to talk for us a little bit about how that's been and what your experience of that has been. The Via Dolorosa, if you go to Israel, if you go to Jerusalem, it is a street. Was it the street that Jesus walked? Well, we don't actually know. The streets that in question were put in by the Emperor Hadrian, and there are a couple of streets that he built. But they passed right through the Temple Mount, where the temple was, so they needed to make a kind of a detour around it. So it's kind of hard for us to know. It was hard for anybody to know where he really walked. But when you go there, when Christians go there, they will often be taken on the Via Dolorosa, and they'll see the stations there that are marked with a black dot on the building so that you know you're at a station. And some people find it such a devastating experience that there is a syndrome in Jerusalem, emergency rooms. And it's called the Holy Week syndrome. And Christians kind of get overwhelmed at walking the street he walked, and it's just kind of too much for them. And so they have a sort of a meltdown. And it happens often enough that the emergency rooms sort of expect that there will be some, which I think it tells us, it seems to me, how potent these events are for us. And you yourself know, no matter how sophisticated you are, and you're a New Yorker and nothing surprises you, but even when you listen in church to somebody read the story, or, and this sometimes happens in churches, you'll read the Passion together, and different people will take parts, and somebody's going to be the crowd, and somebody has to be Pilate, somebody has to be Judas, somebody's going to be Jesus, and so it's a bit like a radio play that you have in church, and even that, just hearing the words it's kind of devastating. Especially if you're one of the people who has to be in the crowd, who has to shout, "Crucify him! Crucify!" It brings it home. I say, my goodness, who would I have been if I were there? Would I have been one of those people standing there saying, "Crucify him"? I hope not. Who would I have been? Would I have been Peter, denying him? I always said I wouldn't be, but Peter said he wouldn't be too, and he was. So somehow reenacting these events is something we seem to need to do and have from the very beginning. Very, very early on, people were retracing this route and stopping at the places where certain things happened, even though they didn't really know exactly where certain things happened. They needed to, if they needed to make it up, they did. we've said here before that the very earliest stories about Jesus that were circulated among people were the stories of his death. Surprising to us that it wouldn't have been the stories of his resurrection. It wasn't. The very oldest stories we have are the stories of his death. They didn't write down the miracles first. No, they didn't write down the birth narratives until much later, really. The resurrection narratives were written down later. Now, why is that? That the death would be what they'd write down first? Well, it might be because there was this custom of retracing the steps. And they needed a narrative to go with it. They needed something that people, like a program, like you take to church. You know, where are we now in this service? Maybe the Via Dolorosa is a reason why the very oldest writing about Jesus was about this journey. So what we're looking at here is very antique. In the 4th century, there was, of all people, a woman, and this is so unusual. She traveled alone, probably from what is now France. And when we say alone, she probably had a bunch of servants with her. Because if you're going to travel like this for years and years, number one, you're going to be rich. And number two, you're probably really not alone. But she certainly was the only official person in her entourage. She traveled. She went first to Mount Sinai, where Moses receives the law. And then she went to Constantinople, the modern-day Istanbul. And then she traveled to Mount Nebo, where Moses looked over and saw the promised land. Then she went to the tomb of Job. Well, we don't really know where there is a tomb of Job, but there's a traditional, you know how they kind of make up stuff. Well, there's a traditional tomb of Job, and she went there. Why Job? Well, Job was an innocent sufferer. And so for her and for some writers, there is a parallel between Job, the innocent sufferer, and Jesus, who is also an innocent sufferer. We don't have much of a survival of that particular focus, Job, Jesus, surviving today. You're not going to hear about Job in Holy Week. But at one point in history, there was a minor, but it was there, focus on these two innocent sufferers. She went there. And then she came to Jerusalem. And she left what is now the oldest description of how they worshipped in Jerusalem about this during Holy Week. She's a remarkable figure that a woman would write like this. Women usually couldn't write. They couldn't read. Hardly anybody could read or write in those days. Literacy was not at all widespread, but she did. And clearly she must have been a person of wealth. She addressed this description that she had in the form of letters to people back home whom she referred to as sisters, which made some people who were reading these things think, well, she must have been a nun. It's possible, but she's 4th century. This is the 300s. Christians back then typically addressed each other as brothers and sisters. You weren't necessarily a nun because you said the word sister, or a monk because you said the word brother. That was just a description of the fellowship you felt with other Christians. So people often will say she was a nun, but we don't really know that she was that. She talks about the ways in which you were conducted. When you went to these sites, there would be people there. There was a church on every site. There was a church of the condemnation before Pilate, and there was a church of the scourging, the beating of Jesus, and there was a church of Peter's denial. They would build structures to be, you know, a place where you could go from place to place to place and retrace the steps, as people seem to want to retrace the steps. She talks about the Easter vigil that they had, the way they lit the fire. And on Easter evening, that is the Saturday before the day. In the dark, they lit a fire. It was called the New Fire. And they would light the fire, and people elsewhere would see the fire, and they would light their own fire. And then somewhere far away, they'd see the fire, and they'd light their fire. And that's how you knew that Easter was here. Out of the darkness came the fire, the fire of new life. She writes about the way they celebrated the Eucharist. And it's the oldest description of the way they did Easter back then, which didn't include flowers and baskets and bunnies. Just a focus on the rising from the dead, the mysterious passage from death into life that Jesus made. She's really important. They found the manuscript, which was copied from her letters. The oldest copy they have of it is in the 11th century, in the 1000s. There were some fragments that they found that were copies from the 900s. So what happened to her manuscript in between when she wrote it? She wrote it when she got home from notes that she made. So she's making this trip in 380 or so, and she starts writing it in, you know, when she gets home in 385 or something like that. And there's several hundred years passing between when she wrote this thing and the oldest copy of it we have. But that makes a lot of sense. We might say, well, hey, well, that's crazy. That can't be very valid if it sat there for hundreds of years. Well, it didn't sit there. It was copied and distributed. The only way you could read a book was if somebody copied it for you. And so books are very rare, and hardly anybody has them. People who can read them to people who cannot. And you don't just toss them away when you're finished, because it's just too hard to make them. And the people who are writing them don't doodle. Because writing is so hard, and it's so rare, and writing is an important act for them. So the writings that we have, if we have it at all, it's because it's important. So we know that this document by this lady was viewed by the people at the time as being very important. And I think that's kind of unusual, because we often say to each other, this was a terrible time for women back then, and I think it was for sure. But they had no authority and nobody believed them. Well, I think that was often true too. But here was one who did, and her words were treasured, and her testimony about what she saw, which was very immediate, kind of a you were there thing, was treasured and important and survives to this day. So Egeria. Everybody who could wanted to do what Egeria did. They wanted to go to Jerusalem and do this. The other group today, of course, that wants to go to the place, who else wants to go to a place? Christians do. Somebody else wants in your life. Muslims do. They want to make the Hajj, and they want to go to Mecca, and they want to see and participate in the things that Muhammad did. So there is, and the Islam begins in, you know, the 7th century, so this is 700s, 800s. One of the pillars of Islam is to make that trip. So in this time, in the first millennium of the Christian era, people want to make a pilgrimage. They want to go somewhere. They want to be on the scene. And, you know, you and I know something about that feeling. We have the feeling. Haven't you ever had the feeling that if you could have been with him, you would have an easier time with faith, that it would be more... Well, surely I would not have any doubts if I'd been there with him. Never mind that all the people who were there with him ran away, just about. But we think we would not be like that. I don't know if we're right about that ourselves, but we still do wish, kind of passionately sometimes when we think about it, that we could, couldn't we just see them? I would love to see them. I would love to see him. And I bet you would too. The only vision that I've had of him that was visual was when I was a girl. I was 7, and I was at Girl Scout camp, Brownie camp. And I had a flashlight, which I was very proud of. You know how kids love flashlights and stuff. So I had to get up and go to the latrine in the night. So I got my flashlight, and I got up, and I walked out to where it was. And on the way there, in the crossing at the trail, Jesus stood. I knew it was him because he was wearing a long white nightgown, had blonde hair and a beard. Who else could it be? He looked just like he always looked in my Sunday school. So I'm standing there with my flashlight, and he looked at me, and I looked at him, and he said, "Follow me." And I said, "Okay." You know, looking back now, I don't know if that happened or if it was a dream. It feels so real to me now, and I just don't know. I couldn't tell you. But I tell you one thing, it is real now. I guarantee you, he probably did not have blonde hair and a beard. The real Jesus probably did not. But he did for me then. I had a need and I had a desire to see him and be with him that I think we all know something about. And so I had this vision, dream. I don't know what it was. It was suspiciously like my Sunday school books. So at least some of it was manufactured right in here. But nonetheless, it was real and useful. And I think I view this as my first call to ministry. He said, "Follow him." I said, "Okay." So that was a done deal. And pretty much I have. So it's all right. We have a desire to make a pilgrimage. We have a desire to follow. And Egeria did this, and people continue to do this. The Muslims have this desire, and they do it. They want to go to the place, the sacred place where the sacred things happened. Throughout the first 1,000 years and a little later of Christian life, people would, if they could, make a pilgrimage to the Holy Land. And as many people as could did. But let's be real. Who could do this? We got to have money. You got to be able to, for instance, not to work for how long? How long does it take you to get there? A long time. So, you know, you got to go months, perhaps years. Egeria's pilgrimage took about 4 years. So you do got to be able to support yourself that whole time. You got to be able to not work. So who's going to be able to do this? Not peasants, not, you know, rich people are going to be able to do this. Okay, that's... Well, it's nice for rich people to do stuff. They get to do a lot, those rich people. It's good to be one. But what about the rest of us? Also, what's happening, what's beginning to happen in the Holy Land now? Things are happening in the Holy Land, especially around as we get to the year 1000, 1100, and the 12 and 1300s. The Crusades are happening. People are trying to take the Holy Land back from the Moors who occupy it, and so there's a lot of fighting going on. It is, it's becoming a dangerous place to be. The Turks are there. We're scared of them, so I don't want to go there. Also, the trip itself is dangerous. There are highwaymen. There are robbers. You're going to go on this trip. You might not come back alive. It's a hard time. So what do you do? Well, there are some things you can do. Throughout Europe, in France, in Germany, in Portugal, in Italy, lots in Italy, sites called the Sacro Monte, the Sacred Mountains. Enterprising people, usually monks or monasteries or priests, would build what were essentially theme parks where you could go, and if you're not going to go to Jerusalem because it's too far, how about if you live in Paris, could you get to Portugal? Okay, I could do that. Maybe there's one in France I could do. You go, and I've been to them in Italy. It's usually a hill. You follow a winding path, rather like this labyrinth, and along the way are little chapels, little tiny, nowhere near as big as this room, maybe as big as just that corner of the room. So tiny that only two or three people can get in at the same time. And there, statues, maybe wood carvings, usually wood, but some stone statues, some frescoes on walls, scenes of what happened. The House of Pilate will be the first one. The House of Jesus' mother will be one. The House of Simon of Cyrene will be one. You'll go into the chapel, so you have the experience of walking, which is an important thing about it, and is an important thing about this labyrinth. This is the labyrinth room. Hey, you guys at home. We're in the labyrinth room, and on the floor beneath my feet is a labyrinth, which we walk from time to time, and we'll be walking it actually on Good Friday. So it's a journey. It's a journey. And in these sacramenti, you walk from these chapel to chapel, the house to house. Each one is different. Artists took pains to decorate them, and they are beautiful and amazing. I remember in one, when the crowd cries for Jesus to be crucified, this is the one in San Vivaldo in Tuscany. You go in the chapel, and on this wall, there is a jeering crowd. And they're very good at jeering people, so the faces are grotesque in there. And then on the other side, there are Jesus and his people who love him. And you go in, and it's so narrow, you have to face one way or the other. You have to either have your back to the jeering crowd, and if you have your back to them, you're facing Jesus right there, so you become one of the crowd. And they're all shaking their fists, and so you are looking at Jesus, and you have the sense of what it is to be part of that crowd looking at him. Or, well, maybe you don't. You turn around then, and now you have the sense, because you're looking at them, of what it is to be him. Looking at those ugly faces who want to kill you. So sophisticated psychologically to do that. And you know, beautiful, beautiful painting and vivid. So the purpose of these sacramenti was to give people a personal experience, a you are there experience. People want to have it. And these places were all over. It was so a democratization of the pilgrimage. If you got to be rich to go to Jerusalem, well, you don't have to be that rich to go to Portugal. You don't have to be that rich to go somewhere in Italy. So who gets to go? More people. More people can go. Not just rich people. Ordinary people can go. You might be able to go and just make a day of it. And today, people go and make a day of it, and there are always picnic grounds around them. The Pope, of all people, because such high value was placed on the pilgrimage to Jerusalem, he granted a special indulgence to people who go to these sacramenti. So he's saying also, you know what, you can't go to Jerusalem, it's fine. Go to one of these, and it will be the same benefit for you. He was in charge of benefits, by the way. So, out of these holy mountains that developed, emerged things that you had in just about every church. If you think about, okay, the pilgrimage to Jerusalem, the Via Dolorosa, where you go to all the places that he might really have been, then you go to maybe one of these sacramenti and go to each of these chapels and make these journeys. What might be the next way that we could make this even more available to all people? What do you reckon developed then? Stations of the Cross, sure. How many know the Stations of the Cross? Yeah, if you grew up Catholic, you know it. Stations of the Cross are this. They are a journey that you make, and again, it's got to be walking. You walk from one to the other. Even if they're all in a line on a wall, you still have to take a few steps so that you have the sense of walking with Jesus as he's on this journey. And they, and some of them are very, very beautiful. You go into any Catholic church, and many Episcopal churches, and lots of other churches have them now. They'll be, on the wall. They'll be progressive. So the first one will be Pilate condemns Jesus. Second one will be Jesus takes up his cross. Third one, well, I tell you, the Stations of the Cross, there are 14. And they kind of long ago branched out from what we read in Scripture. So there are a few extra things on the Stations of the Cross that they didn't have in the Gospels. But that's why we have poetry. The third thing is Jesus falls for the first time. That's actually not in there. The fourth thing is Jesus meets his mother. That's not in there either. But it's a good story. And so they put it in. Because after all, it is in Scripture that she was at the cross in John. You think that she would have let him make that walk and not followed? Heck no, I wouldn't. No mother would. I mean, I may not want to see this, but I'm not going to let him do it alone. So does it say in Scripture he met his mother? No. Do we reckon he might have? Maybe. Anyway, it's station number four. Number five is the cross is laid on Simon of Cyrene. That is in Scripture. The next one, number six, is St. Veronica. He's sweating, and so she presses her towel on his face, and it comes away with a print of his face. Not in there either, but a very important story, and so it is now. Then he falls for the second time. Again, no, not in there. But the next one is he meets the women of Jerusalem, and he has a dialogue with them. They are weeping, and so that's there. Then the third fall, no, but okay. Then the 10th, he is stripped of his garments. That's in there. The 11th, he is nailed to the cross. That's in there. He dies on the cross. That's number 12. Number 13, he's taken down from the cross. Well, that's in there. Joseph of Arimathea takes him down. And then number 14, he is placed in the tomb. And you go through these. They often will do it in churches on Friday. Lots of Fridays in Lent, but sometimes just any Friday. Because, you know, for traditionally for many, many years, Friday was a fast day no matter what. Didn't have to be in Lent. Didn't have to be Good Friday. It was just a time when you took time off and remembered the sacrifice of Jesus. And, yeah, that was a good thing to do. And they did that, and they did it pictorially. And they acted it out. Theater got its birth in religion, certainly among the ancient Greeks, but also among the ancient Christians. And this is a form of theater. It's a form of acting out something that you believe, which is, it's helpful for us. So the Stations of the Cross and some of the most beautiful Christian art you will see. You go to the Met, you'll see lots of stations. And you'll know it's a station because it will be one of these things. And then down at the bottom, there will be, a line that says, you know, Jesus is stripped of his garments or whatever it says. Might say it in Latin. But it will say something. And they're beautiful. Sometime we'll go to the Met and look at stuff. That would be fun. Now, there's another thing. Who can guess what it might be? It was started in 1634 in gratitude for being delivered from a plague. In 1632, a lot of people died from the plague in this town, and they promised, the whole town promised, that if they were to be spared, they would reenact Jesus' passion. Yes, it's over on the guy. How many have been? Yeah. Well, what a thing. So they did that was 1632 when they made the promise. They had to get stuff going a little bit. The first performance is in 1634, and with only two exceptions, one during the war and one I forget why, but some pope told them they didn't want to do it. I forget why. Oh well. Every 10 years since then. And of course, it's not a large town, but it becomes a large town when the when the performance is going to happen, and the whole town participates in it. It's very interesting the way they do it, because one of the things they do is they have found stories from the Old Testament that to them seem to prefigure events around Jesus. For instance, when Joseph is sold by his brothers, Joseph in the Old Testament, not the father of Jesus, but the other Joseph, Joseph the dreamer, sold by his brothers, they link that to Judas being sold by, selling Jesus. So both are from, so in the Oberammergau play, there is that linkage. They'll have a kind of a tableau of people standing still while somebody tells a story from the Old Testament, and then they go into motion, and we see the Jesus story. Other ones, there was one, which may not be done anymore, about Vashti. In the story of Esther, you remember the king, he had a wife, and she was a little insubordinate. He wanted her to come and see him, and she refused, so he got rid of her and chose a new wife, and it was Esther. So in the Oberammergau, the denial of Vashti is one, and it moves toward the story of Esther. And this is to, we are to understand this to be the denial of Jesus by Judaism. And Esther is Christianity. Which brings us to a point about Oberammergau. Many have had some difficulty about Oberammergau because of the anti-Semitism it enshrines. And especially since the Holocaust, we are, shall we say, a little sensitive about that. Rightly so. So changes have been made in the way Oberammergau is done. I think the Vashti Esther thing, for instance, is not done. There are other things I think that are not done. There's a Job Jesus thing in Oberammergau. There's a Cain, as in Cain and Abel, Judas thing. There is a remarkable one in which Isaac, who's going to be sacrificed by Abraham, right? Remember what has to happen at the very... We talked about that sacrifice a few weeks ago. Remember what had to happen? He takes a bunch of servants to go and make this sacrifice, but as they get closer to the place, he leaves the servants behind, and who has to carry the wood? The victim, Isaac, carries the wood for his own sacrifice. And he says to his dad, well, here, I have the wood, you have the knife, where's the lamb? Okay. We're getting to that. Okay. So the Oberammergau people see in Isaac Jesus carrying his cross to his sacrifice, which is well taken. And it's interesting that we don't do any more with that than we do. But Oberammergau does. So, controversial thing, but still extremely popular, and thousands of people go every year. And there are many, many performances in the years that it happens, so that people, everybody can participate in it who wants to. And so it has its birth way back when in the pilgrimage of Egeria in the 4th century through the history of the sacred mountains. And straight through to a modern continuing tradition of the Oberammergau play. Oh, my goodness, I've done a lot more talking in this, and you haven't said a word. I haven't made you read a single Bible verse, and you people out there, oh, you're sleeping. I'm sorry. Don't wake them. What I'm wondering, if anything that I have said about all this history of the way the scripture has been used, Rhonda, what you got to say? The Easter Bunny. The Easter Bunny is Greek. She, and it's a she because they're the ones that have all the babies, is a symbol of fertility. And so it is a union of the Easter feast with fertility festivals in the spring that relate to the world waking up from winter and we're going to have stuff to eat again, thank goodness. And so anything that is about fecundity and birth and life, which is why we do flowers at Easter and also why we do eggs because eggs are new life as well. So the Easter Bunny is a essentially pagan symbol that it's not crazy that we have the Easter Bunny, nor is it profoundly unchristian, because what are we celebrating when we celebrate Easter? We're celebrating new life. We're celebrating life out of death. And so that rabbits have lots and lots of babies, it makes a bit of sense. It's Christians could do worse than that, and they often have. Jim, what do you know?
I'll never forget that living in a Franciscan parish in the Bronx, that the Holy Saturday Midnight Mass contained every sacrament was performed during that service, a marriage, a baptism, and the Holy Scriptures were read from Genesis 1 onward.
Wow.
And at the offertory of the Mass, the little children in the parochial school came forth with their basketballs, with their little things they had in school to offer them. And
my goodness.
This was
remarkable.
The Midnight Mass.
Uh-huh, yeah. My goodness. Yes, ma'am.
A few years ago, one of the directors made a movie of The Passion of Christ.
Yes. Mel Gibson.
Mel Gibson. I couldn't think of his name. And I watched that movie. I physically got ill and had to get up and leave.
I know. That was a controversy. But, you know, that movie follows the stations, by the way. He's conservative Catholic. And he followed the stations. And it was a bloody movie. But, of course, it was a bloody event. Yes, madam.
I was just thinking, when you talked about the rich traveling, the poor traveled, too, because they had servants.
Well, Egeria must have had an entourage of servants. So the poor got to see that stuff, too. Only they didn't write about it, because they couldn't write. Hey, folks, I think it's time for us to go. Thank you so much, and we'll see you next week.